Thank you for being here. Welcome to Reunion. I'm going to introduce our speaker. Originally from Yakima, Washington, Stephen M. Bradley is professor of Black Studies and History at Amherst College. Previously, he was the inaugural Associate Dean of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Initiatives in the Bellarmine College of Liberal Arts and professor of African American Studies at Loyola Marymount University. He received his PhD in 20th century U.S. history with an emphasis on the Black experience from the University of Missouri, Columbia. Stephen is a prolific writer, and his publications include his newest book, Upending the Ivory Tower, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Ivy League, which, by the way, won the History of Education Society Outstanding Book Award. So if he is ready, yes, I would ask you to help me welcome Professor Bradley.
Good people, it means so much to be here with you this afternoon. I don't know what kind of people you are that come out to a history lecture at 4 o'clock on a Thursday when you've already graduated. My kind of people. Okay, so I'm having some technical difficulties, so we're gonna have to do it analog style and take it back to the days before there were PowerPoint presentations and all of those sorts of things. So if you can follow me still, you might be the kind of crowd that could sit through a 35, 40 minute lecture and still be awake at the end of it, or maybe not. In any event, I'm glad you're here, and welcome back to your beloved Amherst College. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Again, this is my first year at Amherst College, and I'm so delighted to be here. I've had a ball. One of the things that I had to get used to quick, fast, and in a hurry is I guess Amherst College students really do the readings. And so I had to get used to that and catch up to them and get out in front of them pretty quick. And that worked well for me. This semester, I taught two classes. I taught a long civil rights history seminar, which went well, but I also taught a course called Rap Reagan in the 1980s, which went well also. So it was a good time. So today, the title of today's lecture is Agitation Yields Access, and Activism and the influence of activism on higher education from 1962 to the present. And so if things were good for me, I would have showed you a picture of my dear student. Her name is Alicia Sanye. Alicia Sanye, and let's see, I don't deal with Mac computers, but anyhow, Alicia was one of the first people on the ground in the 2014 uprising in Ferguson, Missouri. She was there along with her partner protesting the shooting death of Michael Brown Jr. And she, along with my other students, were tear gassed and pepper sprayed, and one of my students was shot with rubber pellets. And I mention this to you because Alicia became one of the young leaders of this campaign in Ferguson. And because of what she was doing, I was on the ground with those students. I came out to be with my students after I found out what had happened that night. Alicia participated in what you might call protest, agitation. And that's what she was known for. But what I wanted to talk about today was the idea that her agitation led to a certain kind of access, because after becoming a protester, she took up politics, and more important to her heart than even politics was policy. And so she ran for the school board and won a position on the school board. This is in St. Louis City, got a position on the school board, and most recently she can boast upon the teachers, all the teachers in St. Louis getting a raise of, I can't remember how many thousands of dollars. And so this was part of her campaign. And this is important because it went from agitation to access to providing better resources for the people. And so if things were going right, I would have went from Alicia's image to that of somebody we all know, that of Frederick Douglass. If any of you alumni are filmmakers, how come there's not a film on Frederick Douglass yet? I don't know. I'm waiting on you all to do it. In any event, Frederick Douglass said, and we should all learn from this quotation, that power concedes nothing without demand. It never has and it never will. Power concedes nothing without demand. It never has and it never will. This is important because he was talking in the 1850s. He was an abolitionist. He was somebody who stole his own freedom. And then he could have went off into the sunset and bought a Cadillac. But instead, he fought for other people's freedom. He agitated for other people's freedom. And this is important because he understood that for people, and I use Frederick Douglass's quotations when I talk about higher education in particular, especially when African Americans and others are discussed, people had to agitate in order to get access. And so from there, I would have shown you a picture of this fine gentleman. His name is A. Philip Randolph. I won't be able to show you the picture. A. Philip Randolph was a labor organizer. I don't know if you all had ever heard of something called the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. You heard of that? Yes, yes. The Pullman Porters, yes, yes, you've heard of this. And so, super important. When we talk about African Americans in this country, you know African Americans. I'm talking to Amherst alumni. I'm not talking to Williams alumni. They wouldn't know this, but you know that African Americans have participated in every war and every conflict that this nation has participated in, right? As engaged. However, in World War II, African Americans had to fight for the right to fight on behalf of the United States. Do you follow me? I wasn't mixing up my words. They had to fight for the right to fight on behalf of the United States. And A. Philip Randolph, along with many other African-American leaders and followers, sought to lobby Franklin Roosevelt to desegregate the U.S. military. Of course, Roosevelt couldn't do it because he was afraid of losing the Southern Democratic vote, okay? But what he was able to do, what A. Philip Randolph and other agitators was able to do, is to desegregate the war industry jobs. What that meant that 1 million new jobs opened up to African Americans. And so if you're trying to figure out, like, how did Harlem get to be so black? Like, how did the South Side of Chicago get to be so black? How did Detroit get to? This is how it happened, by way of a migration that took place because of these jobs opening up to create all of the weaponry, all of the munitions for World War II. A. Philip Randolph didn't stop there with the jobs. So you get your Fair Employment Practices Commission because of the work he was doing in World War II. But after World War II, he kept lobbying the President of the United States, who was Truman, and that's how you get the desegregation of the military in 1948 because of this agitation that occurred. Now, A. Philip Randolph, of course, you know, agitated a little bit stronger than writing dirty letters to the president. He threatened the president during World War II with a march on Washington. And some of you all probably went to the March on Washington in 1963, or at least know somebody who went. This is what he was threatening in the 1940s during World War II. Some people said that would have been totally improper. You would have embarrassed the United States. You mean the United States wasn't embarrassed to fight to free a nation that is going through a genocide with a segregated military? And so this agitation was necessary for access shortly afterwards, of course, you know, the United States engages in a Korean conflict. My father was one of the soldiers who helped to desegregate the U.S. military, and he ended up getting a Purple Heart in that war, and then going on to fight in Vietnam in a very, you know, controversial war, and we'll talk about that in a second. Somebody who signed up for the military in an effort to protect his countries and the interest of his country was somebody by the name of James Meredith. Many of you have heard his name. James Meredith was a Mississippi man. James Meredith joined the Air Force and was in for, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, somewhere along those lines. He resigned his post in the Air Force and heard, he was inspired by John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy and the idea that ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. In his mind, in James Meredith's mind, he said, what I can do for this country is to desegregate its institutions. And so he took it upon himself to wage war. This was what he was thinking in his mind, to wage war on segregation, on racism. And so in doing so, he made application to the University of Mississippi. Now, others had tried to go to the University of Mississippi. You'll remember somebody by the name of Medgar Evers. He had tried to go to the University of Mississippi. They denied him. Well, this was going to be a tough play for the University of Mississippi because he was totally qualified to attend the institution. And in doing so, he made application. I love how he did this. And so please follow me if you can. It's hard for you all to imagine this, but I've been skinny most of my life. I know it's hard. I haven't been as buff as I am now. And so when you're skinny, you learn rules of fighting. Now, the number one rule of fighting when you're skinny is to fight loudly so somebody can come break it up. Right? That's number one rule. But there's other rules. That is, when in a fight, you have to hit first and hit hard. And that is, you do that because you don't know if you're going to live to see the rest of the fight. So you got to get off your licks early. James Meredith, who was about 5'7" and slim built, he followed this rule of fighting. And so he made his application to the University of Mississippi. They called it Ole Miss. And they sent back, the registrar sent back information and said that you should qualify, and here's a catalog. And he sent back a note, and this is where he's hitting first and hitting hard. Agitation yields access. Watch this. He sends a note to the registrar stating, thank you so much for the materials, and I greatly look forward to registering for classes for the fall. And just to let you know, I'm a Mississippi man, I'm a veteran, and also I happen to be a Negro. Don't you know that Ole Miss didn't send a letter back, not a postcard back? They sent a telegram. They sent a telegram to let him know that registration is now closed and you will not be able to enter this institution. Now, for most people, this could have been the stop sign. This could have been it. But war was on his mind, the idea that he was going to wage war on racism, that he was going to wage war on segregation. And so he brought suit against the University of Mississippi. This suit went back and forth through the state, through the circuits. It eventually went to the Supreme Court. Arguing on his behalf, and I want you to remember this, is a woman by the name of Constance Baker Motley, who should have been the first black woman on the Supreme Court. She, of course, went on to become, you know, borough president of Manhattan and the first black woman to be on the federal bench. Ketanji Brown talks about her, and well, she should. That's who was representing James Meredith. Well, I mention this because that would have been enough in terms of courage. That would have been enough in terms of the war for many people. But it was just starting, because the governor of the state, you know the story, didn't want him to attend and said, no black student will attend Ole Miss as long as I'm governor. Okay. Meredith took that as a challenge. Ross Barnett, who was governor, his campaign slogan was never integrate was what the never was for. Meredith remembered that. Go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court rules, you have to admit this guy. There's nothing wrong with him. You have to admit him. He goes to register, of course. Upon finally getting permission to register, people from out of town came. People from out of town with firearms and guns came to prevent him from attending Ole Miss. He's in the dormitory. Outside, a riot erupts. They start burning cars. They start burning things. They called the National Guard to come and protect the campus. The National Guard, many of whom were sympathetic to segregationist policies, turned out to be useless. Meredith wanted to find out if the Democratic president, Kennedy, would actually protect the rights of all citizens. Of course, Robert Kennedy was the attorney general at the time. You remember all of this, right? Anyhow, they had to send the U.S. Marshals to protect the campus. I tell a long story to tell you this, that by the end of this riot, two people had died, had been shot. Two people had been shot, and millions of dollars had been spent. For what? For this 1 5'7" Air Force veteran to attend college and university. But had it not been for his agitation, there wouldn't be access. This is mightily important, mightily important. Of course, he would go on to take up his own kind of politics. James Meredith was an interesting figure. But he should be mentioned when we talk about higher education, because that's what it took. It took agitation. Let me see if I can do this real quick. Some of you all might remember this name if I can get it right. Let me see if you can remember this name. Does anybody remember Mario Savio? Mario Savio, born of a Sicilian father and a mother. His mother was from Italy, but born in the United States. Mario Savio was out in Berkeley going to graduate school. But that wasn't just his function. See, this is important because in order to gain access, you have to do more than just stay in your lane. You might have to get in somebody else's lane to gain access. And so he was a graduate student, of course, but he had also participated in the civil rights effort. He had gone down to Mississippi, the same Mississippi that James Meredith was. You still following me? Still awake? The same Mississippi, and participated in something called Freedom Summer. Mario Savio, who was not black, went down to participate to issue black people the right to vote in Mississippi. This is important to me. This is important to me because these are the same voting rights people are fighting for right now. I don't want to get fired. It's my first year, so I'm not going to talk. He comes back up to California, to the Bay Area, where he gets arrested fighting to desegregate a hotel in San Francisco. See, we like to think all the evil, dirty racism is down in the South and Mississippi. It's easier for us to think that way. But we don't think about Jim Crow North or Jim Crow West. We don't think about that. Well, he got arrested doing that. And then on campus, he decided that he wanted to show support for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the South, which had done the Freedom Summer, and the Congress of Racial Equality. And so he was passing out information. Look here, Berkeley, the University of California, Berkeley, said, we don't allow for this kind of political action on campus. Let me tell you something. Berkeley, along with many other institutions, had participated in research for defense for the United States of America during this controversial war. Don't forget about the Cold War. Don't forget about there's a Vietnam conflict going on. This is 1964 that I'm talking about. Now, the United States hadn't jumped full well into the war, the conflict yet. The Gulf of Tonkin was surely on its way. Mario Savio, of course, when told not to do this, continued to do this. And he was arrested along with some of his other comrades, I guess you could say. When he was arrested, students surrounded the police car, and they said, we could see better if we sat. And so they held a sit-in around the police car, preventing the police car from moving. Mario Savio, along with others, took his shoes off. I'm not fixing to do that. Took his shoes off and stood atop the police car. And he talked about the idea that it is the responsibility of young people, of students, to put their bodies on the wheels of so-called progress that lead to death. That we have to put our bodies on to grind the wheel of the military-industrial complex to a halt. The wheels of racism, institutional racism, to a halt. That, of course, was the start of the free speech movement. Students would end up taking over campus buildings so that they had the opportunity to share what they learned about the civil rights movement on campus. You see, this is the kind of banning that occurs in places. Savio, of course, went on to become the face. That campaign in 1964 became the model for other student campaigns throughout the nation. So I wrote a book about Columbia University, which had a major conflict in 1968. Students there wanted their university to not participate in something called the Institute for Defense Analysis. The Institute for Defense Analysis. They wanted Dow, the chemical company, not to be able to recruit on campus. They wanted to make sure that there were no military recruiters on campus during this Vietnam War. More than anything, they wanted their university to cut ties, and this may sound familiar to some of you all, to cut ties with the defense industry altogether. There were black students on campus. Black students, of course, wanted more black students on campus because there were so few. We know Harlem is right next door to Columbia University. Columbia University, along with other institutions, had participated in what some people called a land grab, where it expanded into West Harlem and Morningside Heights, purchasing residential buildings, displacing residents. They say between 58 and 68, some 10,000 residents had been displaced, maybe 8,500 of whom were black and Puerto Rican. It was easy to tell. It was easy to tell that a neighborhood was being engineered in a way. Black students went to the community and asked, how can we be useful to you, relevant? This is a term that students from the 60s always said, relevant. How can we be relevant to the needs of the community? And they said, you could prevent this university of yours from expanding into Harlem, and you could prevent the university from building this gymnasium in Morningside Park, which is a park that separates Columbia from Harlem, from West Harlem. The university planned to build a gymnasium because the university was excellent at basketball. It won championships, but its gymnasium was putrid. It was nasty. It stunk. And so they needed to build a new gymnasium. They thought we should build a new gymnasium next to the softball fields that we had commandeered in Morningside Park. At the time, they had got a few acres for a softball field. They leased that. The person in charge of the lease at the time was somebody by the name of Robert Moses. Maybe some of you all have heard of Robert Moses. That's a different Robert Moses than was down with Freedom Summer. This Robert Moses made New York look how it looks now. Robert Moses told Columbia University, well, look, I can't sell you any land in this park, but I can lease it to you for this gymnasium. We'll do, how about a 99-year lease at $3,000 a month for a public park? Do you hear me? For a public park, a private institution in a public park? People in Harlem protested against the park. But it didn't come together until students, including white students who had been participating with some of those residents that had been displaced, white students, black students, started agitating Columbia University. They eventually came together to take over campus building. They took over campus building, and then they separated along racial lines. The black students said, if you white students are really down, then you go take more buildings, but this has to be a black building. They took over what's called Hamilton Hall. They renamed it, of course, to Malcolm X University. Alexander Hamilton, I'm sure, was turning over in his grave. They didn't make a play about this. They need to make a play about this is what they need to do. Students took over for a week before the institution sent in 1,000 New York police officers. And you all may remember this from the newspapers. When they came in, they met people like Tom Hayden. I don't know if you've ever heard this name. Tom Hayden, who was an SDS leader. He had been down at Freedom Summer. He had been a tenant activist. When the police removed these students, many were beaten bloody. I don't know if you know, but I realize this on the streets of Ferguson. It's hard to remain neutral on an issue when you see your buddy getting tackled by police or beaten by police or bloodied by police, even if you are not sympathetic to their particular politics. The result of this was the radicalization of students. People all around the world saw how police were bloodying the heads of Barnard students, Barnard women who were on campus protesting. In France, they shouted, two, three, many Columbias. The university never built that gymnasium in the park. Never built that gymnasium in the park. They built it on campus. And for a quick moment, and this is just reality, they stopped expanding into West Harlem. I said for a quick moment because you all can read the newspapers and you know what it looks like in Manhattanville and that sort of thing. That was the case there. That was the case at the University of Pennsylvania with the university expanding into Mantua, which is now known as University City. I mentioned agitation leads to access because that's how I got my job. And this would be one of the final things that I talk about. Out in the Bay Area in San Francisco in 1968, students had decided that black people were worthy enough of having their experience taught and learned at the university and college level. At San Francisco State College, the very first black student union decided that they wanted what's called a black studies program. There had never been one before. And so they brought it to the institution. The institution said, we'll handle all of the academic stuff. You all get to taking notes and study. Agitation leads to access. They coalesced, the black students coalesced with the Latino students, along with the Native American students or the indigenous students, along with the Asian students, along with radical white students. And they eventually took up a strike, similar kind of strike that occurred back at Columbia University. Took up a strike. That strike at San Francisco State College lasted 5 months. They were protesting for a black studies unit, but not just a black studies unit, for a college of ethnic studies where you could have Native American studies, where you could have Chicano studies, where you could have all of these. They went through a chancellor and a president resigning. They fought with police. It was unfortunate. But I mention this because by the end of 1968, going into 1969, San Francisco State College, eventually San Francisco State University, had the first black studies unit in all of the United States. And colleges and universities all throughout the nation were creating black studies units. That's how I got my job, you understand? The black student union that they created, you had one here. That black student union is the reason why there's that mural, beautiful mural inside of the octagon. I don't know if they let you in there for this weekend. Go on in there and check it out. Beautiful. That's important to me. That's important to me. If I could, I would have fast-forwarded. I would have fast-forwarded to Princeton University students in 2015, 16, and 17. Who protested. They called themselves the Black Justice League. One of the things that they protested for was they needed counselors, therapists of color on campus to help with things because things are stressful. They wanted more funding for their Black Studies units, but they also wanted to contend with the naming of buildings, particularly the name of Woodrow Wilson being on buildings at Princeton University. Woodrow Wilson, of course, is the beloved alumnus of Princeton University. He taught there, right? He was president at Princeton before he was president of the United States. He made sure that both were segregated, of course. Somebody who brought the League of Nations and democracy abroad was unfortunately not able to do so here in the United States with regard to race. And so they pointed that out. Now, I only mention this because now, I was just at Princeton less than a month or so ago. Now, I had a chance to go into what's called Toni Morrison Hall. You see what happens. This is important. Now, some of you are saying, this is tragic. This is tragic. Some of you are saying that. That's important. And I want you to say that because that's how culture changes. That's how culture, somebody had to put the name, the original names on the building. Somebody's going to come along and change the names. That's important because that's how culture evolves, and that's important. So from 62 to the present, I'll say this. It took young people who were crazy enough to think that they could stop a war. It took young people who were crazy enough to think that they could stop racism to create access for people like myself who were able to go on to college and graduate school and to join the professoriate. And I appreciate you staying awake for this whole time. Thank you so much. I think we can do questions or comments or something along those lines if you all would like. And I'm ready. The only thing I ask is just you tell me your name and maybe what class you were or what's your function nowadays. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Dan, class of
95. Oh. I love it. I love it so much.
It is a great book. It's a thick
It's a yes.
He wrote that when he was at Yale, but he had been working on Frederick Douglass.
Yes, he had.
Another book about him while he was here at Amherst, had been engaged in that for a long time. But I do have a question.
Yes, sir.
I teach at a different school, the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City, where this curricular revolution that you say started at San Francisco State never happened. We just a few years ago. We're a 75% student body female campus, and there is no women's studies department. What advice do you have to these people who never made it where everybody else started going in 68?
Catch up. I think, in seriousness, one of the things that we're starting to understand is the importance of getting a broader sense of what the United States is and how it doesn't harm the United States to learn more about itself. It doesn't harm people or what we know as current knowledge or old knowledge to do so. That's part of evolution. Young people, I think, have to be at the vanguard of this, though, and we have to be willing to support young people along those lines. In this day and age, it's clear, and I've done a survey of this, most of the reputable institutions of higher education have some form of Africana or Black studies, have some form of women and gender studies. There should be a tinge of I would say embarrassment not to be able to get to that point. And I think there's no other way to say it as far as I'm concerned, because that's what's often worked. That's a very prestigious institution, of course, and making that known has always worked for other student agitators that we're behind and we could be better. And so, yeah, excellent question, and good luck to you. In the back there and then right there.
My name is Douglas. I'm a filmmaker.
Yes.
My question is, what type of institutional and government pushback, whether like through organizing programs like COINTELPRO, et cetera, has there been to the development of Black studies in academic institutions?
It's actually been a hard row to hoe. Think about UCLA in the late 1960s. There was we could talk about San Francisco State if you want. One of the early professors, one of the people they wanted to lead the Black Studies unit, had some affiliation with the Black Panther Party. Now, I mentioned this because you mentioned COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, was outfitted by the Federal Bureau of Investigations to neutralize the Black Freedom Movement. Now, I'm not telling you anything that I don't know. You can look it up yourself. As a result of this, of course, Nathan Hare, who was this person that I was telling you about, he was surveilled. And don't forget, at that time, there was a governor of California who was a former actor, who was a former union man who eventually came out against unions, who was a sworn enemy of the Black Panther Party. And so he called for the resignation and the institution not to hire this particular professor, this Nathan Hare. Of course, he got hired eventually, but this is important to note. Further downstate in UCLA, there was another person, one of the smartest people in the movement. This is somebody who had spent time studying with Marcuse, who had spent time in Germany studying, a woman by the name of Angela Davis. Maybe you've heard of her. Angela Davis had taken a post in philosophy and what would become Black Studies at UCLA. They called for her firing and resignation because she, as a member of the Panther Party, she believed in Marxist-Leninism. And so part of the reason I talk about these things is because sometimes people don't understand tenure. Like, that's what tenure was for, is so people can have their ideas, political ideas, and as long as they're studying things on the up, then everything should be all right. So there were pushbacks all along the way. Students were surveilled, and what would happen is black student unions, the Students for a Democratic Society, they'd be infiltrated. Oftentimes at demonstrations, there would be provocateurs. They would say things like, let's throw this Molotov cocktail. Why would we do that? And then the next thing you know, everybody's getting arrested. And so, yes, there was that part of the whole thing. But let me just tell you this, because I don't want to paint this just one way. One of the factors that cut against black studies were some of the most liberal white professors there were, some of the people that marched with King. For them, they said, we shouldn't have a particular unit just to study black people, that it should be studied in all the subjects, and that we should incorporate it into the history. I'm sensitive to that idea. I think we should. And I think that they had hundreds of years to do that. And now when young people come up with this idea for a black studies program, now we can't do that. So I think you can have a black studies program, and I'm part of the black studies department, and you could have a history department that incorporates black history. So I'm for it all in that way, but there was pushback. And I mentioned that because there was liberal pushback and there was conservative pushback. And that's how it happens. And that's why agitation yields access. My man, right back here in the cap, and then we'll come right here.
I'm not sure I have the courage to say what I'm going to say, which is a little bit conservative.
Come on with it.
So you go back to the free speech movement emanating from Berkeley.
Mm.
And it eventuates in the riots of the Democratic Convention
in 68.
Chicago in 1968. So there's conservative pushback against what is proper revolution that maybe is pushed a little bit too far, and gets a Richard Nixon elected. And if you take a look at our current awful Supreme Court, it all started with Richard Nixon. So there's a price to pay for appropriate progressive action that pushes just a little bit too hard.
I am sensitive to this. Your argument that you just made is the argument that before he died, Todd Gitlin, who was a leader of the Students for a Democratic Society, was the argument that he made that we had gone too far by not finding a Democratic candidate to throw support behind in 68. I would say that there is the possibility of that. There is the possibility of that. But the problem is, if people are marginalized enough, it's hard to contain, it's hard to moderate by the time they seek to fight back and resist. Yeah.
Remember, these people ridiculed Martin Luther King.
Oh, of course they did. Of course they did. Of course they did. And that's a young person thing to do, by the way.
My sense, as an 80-year-old, is damn it, he pushed just a little bit too hard and weren't smart.
I think you're right, but I also think There's hindsight. Yeah, there's hindsight that allows us to see these things. Let me come right here, then we'll go back there, and then we'll come back through. Come.
Yeah. I come from Florida. The state has passed a law that applies to elementary school and high school, that you can't teach things that will make the students uncomfortable. History is uncomfortable. Now, I know it's a posturing sort of thing, and I probably won't stand up in court. But what do we do now? It's as if we have been sent back enormously, and it's...
No, it's a terrible problem. It's a terrible problem. In the sense that I always tried to understand, like, what would it be like to like, live in times, you know, when Frankenstein was written, like, to live in these times when people burn books. And I always wondered, I understand now what it feels like. So this is backtracking in terms of civilization, as far as I'm concerned. And so I'm trying to keep my job. Please don't get me fired. I like it here. Here's what I would say. It's going to require an underground effort if it comes to that. An underground effort, that is, co-curricular schooling outside of school. That's going to be necessary to move forward. But more than that, it's going to require an engagement, a civic engagement that we haven't seen the likes of in a long time. And when I say civic engagement, I mean going to school boards. Like people literally having to go to their school board meetings to participate in these efforts to check some of these extremist ideas, and nobody thought we would have to go this direction, but it's important that we do. So we're in a situation now where I'm not sure that forward is the direction that we're headed. And so it's a wonderful point that you brought up. Yeah, thank you. Let's see. I think we were over here in the red shirt.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of times now. Tongue in cheek, I hope, the precarity of being a first year professor. And it raises the question, is activism safe for a professor at Amherst? And I ask this somewhat informed by Kim Townsend's book about John William Ward, paid a price for his anti-war habit. Is it safe, even today?
Is it safe? No, it's never been safe. Never will be safe. I happen to be tenured and a full professor, so I kid a little bit. But please, I'd like to keep my job. Thank you. But the truth is, like, so when I'm studying for this, you know, when I'm writing this most recent book about these Ivy League schools, it was dangerous because professors were marginalized in a lot of ways. If they were junior professors, somehow they didn't meet tenure when it came time. But this is what I know of activists, having been amongst activists. Somebody's going to have to take this risk. And the idea is this, that if I have to give up or alter my career plans to make sure that this cause is pushed to the forefront, then that might have to be it. And that's a price that people are willing to pay. And let me just say this, people paid that price for us to be able to do what we're doing, for professors to be able to teach controversial topics. As the brother said up front here, if I were in some states, I might get in trouble for talking about all of this. And so people have paid the price to do these things. So it makes it tough. I think there's a line that professors have to be able to draw. In the classroom, I want to know what students are thinking. I want to know how they're thinking. And I want to provide them with as many resources to enrich their thinking. Do I want to proselytize? That's not my business. That's not my business to do. However, if you want to see what I do after I'm at school, then that's up to you. And we can talk about things after class if you'd like. And so that's the way I'm seeing it right now. Let's see. It was you. Yes, sir.
Brian Cristaldi, class of 62. Asian Americans today are agitating for a non-discriminatory process, which they think would give them greater access, particularly to first-tier universities throughout the country. So I think they're taking a page from the Meredith Ole Miss book. This, the going to the Supreme Court, as I understand it. And that's one way we can resolve this issue in this country. I guess there are other ways, and I wonder, do you think that's the way it ought to get resolved? Do you have any view on how it will, what the outcome will be, and what the repercussions might be?
Yeah. Well, thank you for the question. And you're referring to essentially this is an affirmative action challenge that's coming to the Supreme Court. And the case itself had been spurned by some Asian Americans, but also some opponents that had been pushing against affirmative action for the last, I don't know, three or four decades. And they happen not to be Asian American. So you ask, what do I foresee? I foresee affirmative action being knocked down within the next decade or so. Now you ask what I think should be done. I think that Harvard University, which is at the forefront of this this case, should be able to determine what a class looks like in terms of diversity. It's been proven to racial diversity is what I'm speaking about. It's been proven to help with students' development along those lines. And so I think it's going to be part and parcel of a larger kind of culture war that we're engaged in right now. And so I don't know precisely what the Supreme Court will rule on this, but I've read wonderful testimonies from people like Ruth Simmons and others who have explained what affirmative action has done for them. I am, let me just say this, unabashedly a beneficiary of affirmative action. And one of the funny things about being a beneficiary of affirmative action, and people are like, oh, I wish I could have been black so I could have got a scholarship. You could try being black for a while. I say give it a shot. Give it a shot. And sometimes people try to make you feel bad for being a beneficiary of affirmative action. And I say, if you study history like I do, that would be the least you could do for me. That would be the least. So, and nobody ever took my tests and my quizzes or wrote my three books or anything like that. Nobody ever did that for me. But this will be challenged, of course, at the highest court of the land. And if I was predicting anything, it won't take but a decade or so for affirmative action to go away, if I were predicting. Yeah. It's unfortunate in my mind. It's not a cure-all affirmative action, but it is but one tool that works towards access, as far as I'm concerned. So let's see, somebody else had a hand. Oh, there you go.
Wondering what your perspective is on Amherst. They've worked very hard, created an incredibly beautiful community. Where is education needed here?
Yeah.
Educationally, what do you see in your observation?
Absolutely. So coming here, you know, I was coming from Los Angeles. And so coming here, one of my big fears was like, oh my goodness, you know, coming from one of the most racially, ethnically, you know, culturally diverse places in the United States, coming to Amherst, Massachusetts. And I was so pleased to find how hard the admissions office is working to diversify the student body. And this is important to note, that we think that with diversity comes a lowering of standards. No, let me just tell you, because I teach these students, there were no standards lowered in attracting these students. So the college has done especially well in recruiting a diverse student body, a racially diverse student body. The college is working towards recruiting a faculty that reflects some of the new gains in diversity in the student body. And I think that that's a next step. When we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we have my man, Professor Alan Hart here, who is an expert, who is a wonderful professor, he will tell you that the arrival of people on campus is just one thing. How people get to participate in and engage in decision making is another thing. That's what we need to work towards. The culture of the whole place, where nobody would think that a Black Studies class is something for Black students. You see what I'm saying? Everybody's for that. And so, thankfully, I've had very diverse classes along those lines. So, yeah, wonderful. Let me get, I think the sister in the black had a question. No. Yeah. There's, congratulations. Yes, yes. I'm here because of the Amherst Uprising. I jest, but I don't. Yeah, I'm serious. Like, yes, this Amherst Uprising was something that that I was able to read about before ever coming here. And this was something that changed the institution because the institution was ready to listen. But it had to be made to listen in some ways. And thank goodness you had good leadership that was available to listen. And that better than that, you had students who were willing to sacrifice themselves to make these advancements. So because of that, you see various programs in the biology and chemistry departments in the science building that work towards helping disadvantaged students to engage the STEM disciplines. You have other sorts of things as well, including this push to attract faculty members of color to diversify the counseling center. This was also part of it. To me, this was required. This was required. Now, this comes at a price, though. And this is what I always say. Somebody had asked a wonderful question about the price of this, the cost of all of this. Students end up having to be soldiers, end up having to be negotiators and everything else when they should just be educated and learning. They should be worried about what kind of beer they'll be drinking responsibly if they're over 21, right? That's what they should be worried about. But instead, they're worried about these very real and very, very entrenched issues regarding institutional racism, regarding things like citizen status, regarding all of these gender and other kinds of statuses. And so I'm thankful for this. And I think if you ask Biddy Martin, I think if you ask Catherine Epstein, if you ask most of the faculty members, they would say that they were thankful for this uprising because it allowed them to reflect on something that they had known was the right thing to do for all of these years, and this propelled them. And so thankful for those students, definitely. We'll go right here and then to the gentleman in the cap.
Yeah, I'd like to add a footnote to what my neighbor here pointed out about 1968. There was a Democratic candidate who might have won. It was Robert Kennedy, but unfortunately...
My goodness.
So I should remind us that, you know, historical generalizations have to take account to the chances, the odd things that happen that disrupt the sort of easy narrative line. Second point, we've had some talk here from you as others about the precariousness of being a college professor. And I think you've several times suggested the answer that the impetus for change that's going to be effective has to come from the students. Because these days, universities are student-centered institutions. Students will be listened to when faculty won't be.
Mm.
Because the students are not in danger of being fired, right?
Mm. Mm.
Students are in a position to be graduated, and everything has to work toward their graduation. So institutions will decide, well, if we need to lay on more diverse counselors, or if we need to hire more diverse faculty to get these kids that we want to succeed, then that will happen.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think you're right in stating that young people, students, have the power on campus. And the truth is, it's been that way always, but... students, I think, are becoming aware of this in many ways, and it's resulted in some changes on campus that have been very, very good. Faculty, of course, you know, we push for things, and it's a push and a pull, and sometimes we win, sometimes we don't, sometimes we get in our own way.
Faculty are employees.
Yeah.
And they can be let go. Students can't be let go.
Yeah, it takes a lot. It takes a lot to get a faculty member to go somewhere. But it's not impossible. Let me just tell you that, Jack. It's not impossible. So, but your point is well taken, that students have the power, and that agitation leads to access. And yes,
in the case. You raise a different issue, but yeah. I think the one you raised is really interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I still see Amherst as faculty driven.
It's very powerful. Yeah.
Certainly not administration. Distinction that Tony Jack famously makes between what's it called, the privileged poor and the doubly disadvantaged.
Yes.
And how careful we have to be.
Yes.
Not looking at, I don't know quite how to characterize it, but this group of students as monolithic.
Mm-hmm.
That these students that were accepting to Amherst without diminution of standards have very different backgrounds.
Yes.
And need care and treatment and support that ultimately has to be completely individuated.
I would love to argue with you, but I can't. You're right. You're right. So what we're talking about is a diversity within marginalized communities, right? So you could have more black students, but if all the black students that are coming are fourth generation college students,
Went to Exeter and Amherst.
And there are quite a few who have, that's very different than coming from where Tony Jack came from. That's very different. And what he talked about that was so crucial is the cultural acclimation.
Right.
That's very, very difficult. Like the rest of this stuff, policy stuff, like people can jump over that and we can make those kinds of changes, but the cultural acclimation is quite difficult. So somebody asked, what's the next steps? This you asked, what were the next steps? This is part of it, is being able to see to the needs of these students who have no clear awareness of what college life is like. And let me just say, after having worked at a number of higher education institutions, Amherst is a little bit different. It's special for a reason, but it's different. And it takes some acclimation to an extent. And so you're right. That requires some kind of an individual attention, and it requires nuanced approaches to the different kinds of students who are coming along. Wonderful point. Yes.
I just want to say I agree with you. I'm Jean. Yeah. I'm class of 82 with Adam.
Hey!
My daughter graduated in 16, and my needs coming from the south side of Chicago, totally different than her needs coming from the northern suburbs of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
This is within my family, so it does have to be individualized.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Can you repeat the comment or question?
Yeah. Or do you want to say it louder? Oh, no, I doubt that seriously. But she had made the point about her being an alumna of Amherst College, but coming from the south side of Chicago, and then having a daughter who is a class of 16 alumna of Amherst College, but came from the south suburbs or where?
The northern suburbs
of Chicago, which was different for those who know Chicago. Which was different. And these students have different needs. You will be able to help your daughter. So things like bursar, FAFSA, these are not common phrases that people know. I know, and here maybe some of us know it, but without some kind of introduction, without somebody to lead you around and show you these things, it makes it for a tough play and a tough time here. So one of the things I just tell you this, I don't want to keep you all day, but one of the things I'll tell you is that some of the students that I've had who are first-generation students here at Amherst have a lot of, what do you call it, mental pressure, like because they're trying to show that they belong. Imposter syndrome is something, and my good psychologist professor talks about this. They're experiencing imposter syndrome, that even though they did especially well in their classes and on their scores, they still don't feel as though they belong because they don't know the same things that some of the other students know. But they forget those other students don't know what they know either. We have to find a way to enrich that and to support that. And that's the next level. That's the next step, really. Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.